Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, and welcome to Running Mate, a podcast for Brits about the US election. In today's episode, what the election will mean for the UK.
Good man is going to be the Prime Minister of the UK now, Boris Johnson. Good man. He's tough and he's smart. They're saying Britain Trump. They call him Britain Trump, and people are saying that's a good thing, that they like me over there.
That's Donald Trump putting his support behind Boris Johnson as he was close to becoming Prime Minister. It was the start of what became perhaps the US President's closest relationship with a foreign leader. And the Tory government charm offensive appeared to be working when Trump suggested he was willing to give Johnson his biggest post-Brexit prize.
I think we'll make a fantastic and big trade deal with the UK. Actually, we should do much more business than we're doing with the UK.
But has the UK made a miscalculation? With the pandemic changing everything, Joe Biden has a strong lead in the polls and, unlike Trump, doesn't think Brexit is a very good idea at all. He's also warned the coveted trade agreement is at risk if an Irish hard border returns, and seems to be of a similar mind to Barack Obama, who he served as vice president.
The United States wants a strong United Kingdom as a partner. And the United Kingdom is at its best when it's helping to lead a strong Europe. It leverages UK power.
So will EU members France and Germany be more attractive overseas partners to a Biden administration? Or will another Trump win breathe life into the special relationship and empower the politics that has underpinned Brexit? Hello, my name's Graham Demnick from HuffPost UK team, and joining me today are two top political journalists. I've got Kieran Stacey, who's political correspondent for the Financial Times, who's based in Washington, D.C. Hello, Kieran. How are you?
I'm all right. Thanks, Graham. How are you doing?
Not too bad at all. And Rachel Wearmouth, who's a political correspondent for HuffPost UK team, and she's based in Westminster. Hello, Rachel. How are you doing?
Hi, Graham. How's it going? I'm sat in a rainy North London. I'm okay. How are you?
How I miss home. It sounds as glamorous as ever. So for anyone coming to the podcast for the first time, this is what we're trying to do. I'm a British journalist living and working in America, and at HuffPost UK, we wanted to try and produce something that made sense of the US election for people back home. This time around, we wanted to talk about what the election result, a Trump win or a Biden win, will actually mean for the UK, if it means anything at all. So I guess we're in special relationship territory, the phrase first coined by Churchill and seemed to enjoy a renaissance under Blair and Bush. The "Yo Blair, what are you doing" line at the G8 in 2006 still tickles me immensely. So guys, where do we think that the special relationship is right now? How has it been under Trump? May and Johnson both seem to try and woo Trump more than other countries. Has that worked, and how is the relationship going? Kieran, do you want to have a go at that one?
Yeah, well, both Theresa May and Boris Johnson were quite early trying to get to Trump. And I think Theresa May had a fairly significant success at first, being one of the first world leaders to get a bilateral summit with him. Yeah. But that was the pinnacle of it, really, for Theresa May. It was all downhill from there. So really what we saw after that was an absolutely terrible relationship between those two people. And we're only really now finding out the extent of how bad it was. But you've got a lot of diplomats and former diplomats saying now, coming out now and saying, well, on the calls, for example, Donald Trump just used to talk over her, used to openly show her contempt. She would struggle to get her points across. Obviously, with Boris Johnson, it's been much warmer. Trump calls Boris Johnson Britain Trump, literally his words. And so he obviously sees himself in Boris. But whether that's actually added up to anything concrete for the UK, I actually don't think it has. I don't think it's been of much benefit to Boris, to be honest.
Yeah, Rachel, how do you see the relationship under the Trump years for the UK?
I would agree with everything that Kieran said about the years under Theresa May. I think it kind of did become very fractious and quite obvious at times that he was actively trying to undermine her. And I think that under sort of Boris Johnson, we've seen a lot of kind of warm words from the president, but yeah, they haven't really added up to anything significant for us. I mean, if you actually look at what's happened during that time, we're sort of trying desperately to get a US-UK trade deal done.
Right.
And he's put a 25% tariff on Scottish whiskey, which is kind of really pressing on Boris Johnson's sore points from a political point of view. You know, it's the biggest problem he has in terms of opposition during this time might be the SNP and Nicola Sturgeon in Scotland. And he's kind of not exactly helping Boris Johnson in that way, yeah.
So the big prize of the last 4 years has been this kind of bumper trade deal that Trump has promised the UK, but that always seemed in conflict with America First. When you hear that sound, we're pausing the chat to explain something in a little bit more detail. There was always something that didn't sit comfortably with Trump's apparent support for Brexit and his own America First strategy. Why would someone who has spent their life portraying themselves as a deal maker offer the UK more favourable terms than they already enjoy, particularly when the UK is desperate to sign something, anything, with the world's superpower? That's before you consider America First, which has seen Trump withdraw from global politics, such as leaving the Paris Agreement on climate change, and adopt a more protectionist stance on trade. That's seen him slap huge tariffs on billions of dollars worth of goods from the EU, Canada, Mexico, and China in an effort to make US goods more attractive to domestic customers. So far, so technical. Let's talk about chlorinated chicken. This is the idea that a trade deal too generous to the US could see products lining supermarket shelves that are lower in quality than the UK is used to. Chlorine washed chicken and hormone pumped beef are two that most come up. But also, and you might want to cover your ears, insect filled chocolates, rat infested noodles, and orange juice containing maggots. That's if the Wilder reports can be believed. No deal has been signed yet, so none of this is certain to happen. And everything could change if Trump loses in November. But a fantastic and big trade deal? Well, as they say on TV news when trying to bail out of a difficult section, I guess only time will tell. I wasn't quite sure whether the UK was going to be sold a bill of goods, which I think is a US phrase. Kieran, what do you think of the prospects of getting this wonderful trade deal that Trump, a big whatever kind of superlative Trump would use to describe a trade deal? Is that actually going to happen, or is this just kind of Trump's hyperbole that the UK government is happy to swallow?
I don't think it's impossible, and I don't think the real barrier to it is Trump and America First. What we've seen throughout the first term of Trump's administration is a willingness to sacrifice pretty much anything depending on what his priority of the day is. So classic on this is the China policy, where we've seen one day the US will be hitting China hard in terms of sanctions, both trade sanctions on Chinese tech companies. The next day, Donald Trump will be saying, oh, well, we'll scrap all of that in order to get a trade deal. So I think Britain's made the correct calculation that actually Trump loves doing deals. And if you can just get one over the line, then he actually doesn't really tend to care too much about the detail. He likes having a piece of paper to sign. There is a deal to be done there. Part of the problem right now is the UK doesn't obviously have the time before the election in 3 weeks' time to get anything done. They were hoping earlier in the summer that they might just be able to do a kind of phase one deal, which is something that Trump loves to do, by the way. So although they're talking about some big knockout catch-all trade deal. What diplomats over here were talking about was something much smaller, something more scaled back, just to get the momentum started, get Trump signed up to something, and then hopefully the process takes over. That's obviously looking a bit more precarious here. But if Trump does get re-elected, I think that is going to be the strategy. Try and just get something small together, maybe that avoids the key tension points of, say, chlorinated chicken or access to the NHS. And then, you know, get the momentum building from there. What we don't know is what Biden's approach to that is going to be. And, you know, that's definitely something they're trying to flesh out right now.
Right. Rachel, has America become more important to the UK government, do you think, since Brexit? I mean, getting this deal has been its kind of top priority to prove it can be this. Completely forget the phrase now, but it's kind of going global or something
yeah.
similar. Was
global
it?
Britain.
Was it? Yeah. Global Britain, that's it. Exactly that. Yeah.
I think sort of when you look at what a US-UK trade deal could actually add to the economy, it's something like only like 0.5%. You know, it's kind of not massive in terms of how it could benefit the UK economy. But from a sort of symbolic point of view, as in like, you know, this buccaneering Britain going out into the world and striking its own trade deals, is sort of it's a big deal from that perspective. But I think a lot of what Kieran was about to mention there, I think, was some of the like, big flashpoints in terms of just how difficult it will be to do a deal, which is not really so much to do with either whether it's Trump or whether it's Biden. It's to do with, you know, American agriculture is not going to change to strike a trade deal with the UK. And there are lots of other points on which we're going to disagree as well. I think sort of if you looked at, for example, tariffs on cars, or if you looked at, you know, we want to actually tax some of the big sort of digital giants such as Amazon, Facebook, you know, and these are things that are going to be very difficult just for American industry to accept, regardless of who's in, you know, the Oval Office.
Yeah, sure. And what does, I'm interested kind of also what a Trump win would mean for the narrative and the kind of discussions we have about populism, sweeping the West, apparently.
Yeah, and I guess you would say that sort of Boris Johnson's victory was sort of the crowning of populism in the UK. You know, it came off the back of Brexit, this huge victory for get Brexit done, for get this sort of radical right agenda going. You know, it's kind of, but I think it would be a mistake to say that they're exactly the same and that one follows the other. I don't know, it's very hard to predict what's going to happen from here on in, I think. It, just in terms of nobody saw coronavirus come in, and we don't know whether this Brexit deal is going to be signed by the end of the year or if it's going to be the type of Brexit that it was before we went into the election, you know, whether it's going to be this Australian-style deal or if we're actually going to end up much closer to the EU and it'll turn out a great deal hasn't changed.
Just, I'll give you one prediction, Graham. Whatever happens in November's election, people will either absolutely with certainty declare that this is now the undefeatable age of populism or the end of populism.
Right.
People always read too much into election results. I mean, I remember when Macron got elected president of France, people were like, oh, this is it. This is the end of populism. See, we've defeated it. Now centrism back. Is back. So look, whatever happens, and the polls obviously suggest right now it's going to be a fairly significant Biden win. If it is a significant Biden win, everybody will say, that's it, that's the end of populism.
Let's for a second talk political theory. No, please, don't run away. We keep hearing the word populism, but what does it actually mean? It's used with such abandon that it almost doesn't mean anything at all. Donald Trump is a populist, and Brexit was a populist uprising too, apparently. Boris Johnson is a populist, and so is the far right in France. But so too is Jeremy Corbyn. They can't all be populists, can they? Well, yes and no, but mainly no. Few agree, but most definitions of populism include something about representing the people, who are good, against the elite, who are bad. You can see it in Trump promising to drain the swamp and Corbyn offering a government for the many, not the few. But where they diverge and why populism is seen as a bad thing is the populists' lack of respect for political norms and posing a threat to democracy. Trump is refusing to say whether he will accept the result of the election. That's a classic populist move. Corbyn was grumpy about losing the election, for sure, but he didn't threaten to upend the result, and he shuffled off to the backbenches again.
completely forgetting that, you know, somewhere between 35 and 50% of the American population would have voted for Trump. And that is quite serious, because Trump is so far divorced from what you would consider mainstream, or what has historically been mainstream American views and values, that you've still got a huge rift there in American society. There was a very good essay actually in The Atlantic this weekend by David Brooks saying that this is a real moment in history, and Americans have catastrophically lost trust, not just in the institutions that govern them, but in each other as well. And there was some very good polling evidence to show how riven American society is right now. So just one thing that I'd say to anybody listening to this is, even if Biden wins, this is not the return of centrism. There is a huge divide in American politics. Trump supporters will be very pumped up if their candidate loses, especially if it's close. And that will continue to be a theme for several years.
And yeah, so that nicely moves us on to Biden. He is ahead quite comfortably in the polls as we speak. His lead has been pretty strong since he became the Democratic candidate. And so do we think in that case that a Biden win would be tricky for the UK, given its willingness to cozy up to Trump and try and get this trade deal? And Rachel, what do you think the difficulties are of a Biden win? What do they present to the UK? And Downing Street reads the polls as well as we do. They must be looking towards the US and thinking, Biden could be the man. Is their gaze changing now, do you think?
There's been a lot of reports in the last few days which would suggest right. That's very much the case, yeah. I think there's been senior conservatives kind of briefing that they're very much switching their focus now to the Biden team and trying to build bridges there. But one of the big problems as kind of, I would see it at the moment, is we've just finished pushing through this internal markets bill, which kind right. of rips up a lot of the withdrawal agreement in terms of Northern Ireland. So the withdrawal agreement was designed to protect Northern Ireland from a hard border with the South by signing up to certain EU rules. And the internal market bill has sort of just rode roughshod over that. And that is a big problem for the Democrats because, you know, it was Bill Clinton's crowning achievement, the Good Friday Agreement. You've got Joe Biden's got, you know, Irish roots, his family has Irish roots, so this is kind of going to be a big issue, I think. And you know, the Democrats have never really liked Brexit.
Right, right. Yeah, no, Biden himself said, had I been a member of parliament, had I been a British citizen, I would have voted against leaving. US interests are diminished with Great Britain not being an integral part of Europe. Kieran, does Biden's Irish-American roots, his opposition to Brexit, does that pose a problem for the UK?
Well, actually, I don't think Biden's Irish-American roots really change the reality of this, which is that there are enough members of Congress with Irish roots that they have threatened several times to kill any trade deal which threatens to undermine the Good Friday Agreement. One of the interesting things in American politics is just how many very senior people here claim ancestry back to Ireland and feel that very, very intensely. And so Irish politics filters through in a way that I've been amazed at since I moved here a couple of years ago. So I don't think actually, you know, Joe Biden being in the White House almost is irrelevant if Nancy Pelosi is already standing up threatening to scupper any trade bill in the House of Representatives, because she's got 20 odd Irish American members of Congress at her back saying, do not, whatever you do, threaten the Good Friday Agreement. That's just a reality of American politics, whoever's the president.
And I think a lot of British listeners probably won't realise that American trade deals have to go to the representatives, right? It has to get past people like Nancy Pelosi for it to become a reality at all.
Yeah, Congress has huge power here. It's not like the UK where the Prime Minister just decides what foreign policy is.
Right, right. And the UK government would say that Biden, Pelosi et al. Have misinterpreted what they're doing. Is that a reasonable position from them, do you think?
I think there has been relatively little focus paid to the internal markets bill over here in the US in the middle of an election campaign, if I'm being honest.
People will be surprised to hear.
But I think there is a broader question about misinterpreting both Boris Johnson and misinterpreting Brexit. And that is definitely true. And that is something that I know Downing Street is worried about right now, is that because Boris has managed to get himself billed as some kind of version of Trump over in the UK, which I think was always a strategic error for multiple reasons. But because of that, they're now desperately trying to backpedal. They've also just appointed as ambassador here Dame Karen Pearce, who's a very credible diplomat, used to run the UK's mission to the UN, but was also appointed with half an eye on the fact that she got on with Donald Trump. And I think now she and her team are kind of trying to make those contacts with the Biden team as well. And this is the problem, really, when you go in hard for one candidate or the other, you know, suddenly you have to start tracking back. But definitely here in the US, as you'll know, Graham, there is a very easy narrative of Brexit and Boris are just a version of Trump. And that is not really true. Brexit happened for a lot of very different reasons. And Boris Johnson is a professional politician in the way that Donald Trump is not. And actually, the two of them, even now, you're seeing the way that they're handling coronavirus and their own bounce of coronavirus. It's completely different. And that kind of tells you something about the different characters they are. But I think in Downing Street now, they're desperately trying to demonstrate that. And I wouldn't be surprised if you see Boris acting very quickly after a Biden win to try and get in there, because they're desperate not to be billed as just another version of Trump.
Yeah, Rachel, how are Downing Street kind of balancing this? Boris doesn't seem to be sticking his nose in any way to the US election, which is the opposite to what Trump did in December when he phoned LBC Radio.
Christ,
you've got,
yeah.
Donald from Washington on the line to back Boris. How is Downing Street doing this kind of balancing act, do you think?
Well, I don't know if it's so much that they're trying a balancing act at the moment as just panicking and looking at the reality of the polls, thinking Joe Biden's likely to win. You know, Boris Johnson and Joe Biden haven't really had the best relationship in the past because of several things that Boris has said about Barack Obama. And I think they're kind of just panicking, trying to speak to as many diplomats and people connected in Washington to Joe Biden. But it's worth kind of saying that it's not necessarily going to be Boris who's in number 10 in the years to come. You know, there's already a lot of briefing about how good the Prime Minister's health is, whether he's really up for being Prime Minister once the coronavirus crisis is dealt with. You know, a lot of Conservatives' attention is actually starting to focus now on Rishi Sunak, the Chancellor. So it's not necessarily going to be Boris Johnson who needs to forge a relationship with Joe Biden.
It'll be a really interesting test. I always find these relationships interesting because it'll be a really clear demonstration of how much depends on the personal relationship of the two leaders involved. And I'm always a bit of a skeptic on this. I think that all of these bilateral relationships happen at official level, quite pragmatically. People can come together and just figure out the issues. And then, okay, if you need to get the two leaders in a room, what do they sign up to? Most of that has been agreed in advance. And the UK and the US now, the so-called special relationship, really, I don't think is to do with all of that interpersonal stuff, the cultural connections. I think one reason that the US really values the UK relationship is the intelligence sharing. So I remember I have reported a lot over the last couple of years on the scrap over whether to use Huawei or not. And one of the big things that Americans were talking about is, well, we can't cut off the UK completely because we're really, really dependent on their intelligence sharing. You know, the UK is not, despite what some people think, a completely minor, irrelevant power floating off somewhere in the mid-Atlantic. It is more important than that globally and to the US. But the reality is that outside the EU, the UK's importance to Washington is diminished. And we already saw under Barack Obama him starting to switch from using London as his primary route into the EU to Berlin. And I imagine that will continue to be the case under a Biden presidency as well. I should think that whoever is in power in Germany will be a more important relationship for him than Boris Johnson, whoever's the British Prime Minister.
We'll we'll come back to Kieran and Rachel later, but I've also spoken to Alex Kaufman, who's a senior reporter at HuffPost, and he covers climate and energy policy. We've been talking about Trump's impact on the UK, but we also wanted to look at Trump's impact on the planet and what another 4 years would mean. So this election campaign has been notable for its lack of policy discussion on anything, and that's perhaps been most notable when it comes to climate and the environment. So, Alex, how bad has Trump's stewardship of the environment been over the last 4 years? I think people in the UK will be aware of the US pulling out of the Paris Climate Agreement. That's bad, but what else has he been up to in the last 4 years in terms of climate and environment policies?
Well, there's actually a stark figure that came out of a study released just 2 days ago that I think does a good job of illustrating what he hasn't been doing.
Right.
His enforcement of anti-pollution laws dropped really, really dramatically in the first 2 years of his administration compared to the previous two presidents. So
right.
There was a 70% decrease in criminal prosecutions under the Clean Water Act.
Right.
And there was more than 50% decrease in prosecutions under the Clean Air Act. And that's from a University of Michigan Law School study that came out this week. So that's pretty dramatic. You know, the things that I think are more well known and equally concerning have been the wanton rollback of almost every major regulation that was enacted to limit greenhouse gas emissions. So,
right.
You know, in just the first couple of years, he replaced the rule that was meant to limit carbon emissions from power plants.
Right.
He gutted the rule that was meant to limit methane emissions from oil and gas sites. He changed the fuel mileage standards for American cars, thus putting the cars that will be on the road 5 years from now behind most other developed countries. So it has just been a real historic assault on these policies in just his first couple of years. It's hard to overstate it because there really aren't many other examples of a president doing this much harm in such a short period of time.
Right. And what is the significance, do you think, of the Paris Climate Agreement and him pulling the US out? I mean, he would argue, I'm sure, that the US is doing plenty on its own, but why do you think that's important?
Well, you know, the historic nature of the Paris Climate Agreement is that it was the first big accord between all the major polluters in the world agreeing to cut emissions. You know, nothing before this had united both the United States, the number two emitter, and China, the number one emitter, in agreement on these things. So, you know, the symbolic nature of it was what made it particularly historic. It's a non-binding agreement, so there aren't really legal mechanisms to force signatories to make the cuts that they've agreed to.
Correct.
But, you know, if the world's second largest emitter, the richest country, the military hegemon is not coming to the table, then it's hard to imagine most of the smaller countries that are within that country's sphere of influence really cooperating fully or feeling like there is the adequate pressure to meet the goals that they had set out. It is notable that technically he has not yet withdrawn.
Right.
So the outcome of the election, should it be determined the day of the election, will be quite impactful for the future of the US's participation in that.
And I guess we shouldn't really be surprised about Trump's attitude towards the environment. I mean, what's his views on climate change? I mean, I think there are quotes suggesting that he thinks it's a hoax. Some of the more outlandish climate-related quotations associated to him are, it was created by and for China. It's freezing in New York. Where the hell is global warming? Does he actually not believe in man-made climate change, that it's human actions changing the environment?
You know, it is very difficult to determine the true thinking and cognitive workings of this president, perhaps uniquely so among U.S. presidents. He also is uniquely bombastic and sarcastic,
right.
and there's a sort of postmodern nature to his public communications whereby he stakes out really radical views and intones them with a certain jocular nature.
Right.
That being said, the actions that he has taken as president seem to indicate that he does in fact believe that there is some type of conspiracy of scientists going on here. And this is the myth that has been propagated since the 1990s by largely oil and gas and coal companies that were looking to delay any type of regulation on fossil fuels. So, he has throughout his administration gone after any of the very modest regulations that existed to limit global warming. So that would seem to indicate he's not particularly concerned for the future that his grandchildren and his younger child will live through.
Yeah.
That would seem to indicate that he does in fact buy the stuff that he seems to promote off the cuff in tweets.
And Trump's Supreme Court pick, Amy Coney Barrett, seems to share the same skepticism, should we charitably describe it. And in her cross-examination by Kamala Harris this week, she wouldn't say whether she thought climate change was real or man-made. I think we've got a clip of that now.
And do you believe that climate change is happening and is threatening the air we breathe and the water we drink?
Senator, again, I was wondering where you were going with that. You have asked me a series of questions that are completely uncontroversial, like whether COVID-19 is infectious, whether smoking causes cancer, and then trying to analogize that to eliciting an opinion on me that is a very contentious matter, opinion from me that is on a very contentious matter of public debate. And I will not do that. I will not express a view on a matter of public policy, especially one that is politically controversial, because that's inconsistent with the judicial role, as I have explained.
Thank you, Judge Barrett. And you've made your point clear that you believe it's a debatable point.
And presumably Biden's approach to the environment is very different from Trump. What's he trying to do to kind of unravel the kind of mess that Trump's created?
Yeah, I mean, the first step for him will obviously be replacing this cabinet of industry stooges
right.
with more competent and public-minded regulators and officials. But beyond that, he has said that he wants to transition the U.S. to a carbon-free electricity system by 2035, which is a pretty big step.
Yeah.
He wants to retrofit 4 million homes and buildings with energy efficiency measures and electrification. He wants to build out a pretty massive network of electric car charging stations across the country's highways, which would likely enable a pretty rapid transition there. So
yeah.
Those are really the key takeaways. And he has long campaigned really from the beginning as the person who, as a the number two in the Obama administration, had helped to broker the Paris Agreement deal, and that he would seek to not only rejoin it but reclaim the United States mantle of leadership there. Whether or not that is something he would be able to do, obviously, is up in the air.
But Biden seems to shy away from this term, the Green New Deal, and that seems to be something the Republicans have been attacking both Biden and Harris on. Is the Green Deal significantly different to what Biden's proposing? And why would he not want to get behind it to burnish his environmental credentials?
Yeah, I mean, this is a complex game of politics here. So
yeah.
I think it's important for us to understand what the Green New Deal is. The Green New Deal is a general movement and a policy framework, much more so than a specific piece of policy, and there is a lot more that needs to be done that the private sector and the market would be utterly incapable of doing at the speed that is necessary right now, and with the sensitivity that is necessary to how many ordinary people's lives are going to be disrupted by those actions. So, you know, what the Green New Deal did was essentially offer an anti-austerity framework to addressing climate change, where, you know, these kind of old school, you know, ideas of government action, of, you know, federally led and funded infrastructure, and a certain degree of central planning, you know, things that the United States really hasn't had in the past 50 years, you know, bringing those things back to do large scale decarbonization and to try to make it an equitable transition for the people whose lives will be affected by it. So, you know, this movement really has galvanized a lot of people, and it has garnered a lot of political support. You know, I mean, one of the senators who co-authored the resolution that essentially laid out the core tenets of what a Green New Deal would be last year, a guy named Ed Markey, who's been around for about four decades in Congress.
Right.
And, you know, obviously the so-called AOC wing of the party is really organized around this. So, you know, it is a movement, and it is a symbol of this kind of progressive approach to climate politics. Now, from the get-go, as you might imagine, the Republican Party has sought to discredit it in any way that it could, and has had some very favorable and credulous coverage on its right-leaning kind of propaganda networks, the Fox Newses of the world and the conservative talk radio, where they have smeared it with inaccurate, you know, numbers. I mean, there was one number that was thrown around that it would cost $100 trillion. This is a bogus number that was quite literally fabricated by a conservative think tank.
I don't know how many zeros there are in 100.
Sure, yeah. And you know what? I don't think anybody has calculated it like that, because it's not rooted in any reality here. I mean, the second thing is you know, they claim that it would lead to you know, taking away all meat. No one would be allowed to eat meat anymore. They'll ban hamburgers, and, you know, no one will ever fly on an airplane again. And, you know, these are obviously hyperbolic, you know, projections of what conservatives fear a sweeping climate policy would ultimately mean for these heavily emitting commodities. But, you know, it's not real. Nevertheless, you know, that propaganda network is very powerful. And the Biden campaign is, in fact, proposing something more moderate than the Green New Deal wing of the party is pushing. But he, in fact, has proposed a climate policy that is largely in line with those kind of anti-austerity, government-led approaches that, at this point, I think any credible scientist would say is necessary to execute on the changes that need to happen as quickly as they need to happen.
Alex, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, guys, for the last bit, I just wanted to provide listeners in the UK with a bit of a cheat sheet about American politics. Let's give listeners something that they can use in a pub to impress their friends. So, question one. You're both election night veterans. What's your secret to sustaining yourselves through the wee small hours of the morning? Rachel, what's your go-to to keep you on top of your game?
Other energy drinks are available, but sugar-free Red Bull kind of what I go for. That and sausage rolls, and I would say that as someone
sausage
who's
rolls.
A northerner. So, yeah. Well done.
Thanks for grimly gripping on to northern stereotypes. We appreciate that. Kieran, what's your... How do you stay up at night?
I try and stay up the night... This is a bit ridiculous. I try and stay up the night before... I try and reset my body clock, and every single time it fails, because it takes longer than that to reset your body clock. So I just end up exhausted because I've gone to bed at 3 o'clock the night before and then still woken up at, you know, 7 o'clock in the morning. And I usually find the adrenaline just about manages to carry me through. Oh, if you're watching in the UK, by the way, I presume the thing to do is to go to sleep and wake up early. I'm trying to remember how the time zones work.
Is it called a disco nap? Is that what it's described as? Get a couple hours before everything kicks off. So that might be the way forward. Okay, more politically based question this time. What would the first thing that the UK will notice about the US if Biden wins, do you think? Kieran, do you think anything will change immediately?
I think we're all going to calm down a bit, frankly. And you know, maybe this is just me as a journalist, but I'm sure other people do this too. You know, you wake up and you log on to your news website of choice, or you log on to Twitter, and you just are instantly confronted with a barrage of madness, depending on what's come from the White House that morning. And I think a lot of that, presumably all of that, will then calm down. If Biden does win, it will be on a calm things down ticket, by the way. Right, you know, that's the way he's run his campaign. And the other thing you're going to see change very quickly is the response to coronavirus. And it'd be interesting to know whether, if Biden does take a much harder line on lockdowns, whether he is able to get a grip on things, because we here in the US look like we're just on the beginning of what the UK is seeing now, and whether there's anything that a politician can do to stop that, I don't know.
Rachel, do you think things will, you looking forward to calmer Twitter feeds as a result of a Biden premiership?
Yeah, but I remember writing about sort of Keir Starmer's first 100 days as Labour leader. And one of sort of an insider told me that one of his main aims was to make politics boring again.
Right.
And
right.
I wonder if that'll be, if it's a very similar thing with Joe Biden. But I think what a lot of people will be listening out for is how America is going to pay for the economic fallout of, you know, COVID-19. Because I think that's, you know, there'll be a lot of countries that take their cues from that, and will be just interested to see how he plans to deal with, you know, the economy as well as the disease itself. Yeah, and we might see a president in a face mask for a change, which will be good.
Yeah, well, that's a very good point, actually. Just the optics of seeing Biden adhering to social distancing and being in a face mask will really change things and might start changing people's behaviour. But also, Rachel mentions the economic side of things. It looks pretty much impossible now that we're going to see a stimulus bill here before the election. If there is a Biden presidency, that will happen almost instantly, I'm sure.
Yeah, absolutely. So we talked a lot about the special relationship. Is it ultimately doomed, given the fact the UK is out of the EU, Paris, Berlin, Brussels seem to be more favourable places to turn your gaze? Are we seeing the end of the special relationship, Rachel?
I don't think so. I think it always kind of evolves and changes. But I think there's been a lot of, hopefully, we've spent a lot of these years thinking about the lessons for us as well, you know, and there was a big backlash when Barack Obama tried to intervene in the Brexit debate. You know, there was, you know, a lot of the Iraq war was very unpopular. And there's got that our sort of, whether it's Boris Johnson or our next prime minister, has got to find a way of voicing that skepticism as well as forging a relationship, which is just a very difficult challenge, but obviously one they're going to have to tackle.
Kieran, special relationship?
I think it's already finished. I think it's already okay. Over. But, I mean, really, that special relationship was so much about the joint war effort. And you've now got a generation of politicians who don't remember it. And maybe two generations on from that. And that's also why you're seeing in the electorate, you know, a breaking down of the old social order that was really put in place in the post-war years. Society has moved on from that. The UK and the US have a relationship. It is a very good relationship, but it is no more special than Germany's relationship or, you know, other members of the EU or possibly even Australia's relationship. But the UK does have things going for it. Obviously, it's got a common language, got very, very close security and intelligence bonds, as I was mentioning before, is an important source of trade. So, you know, there are things going for the UK and a reason for the UK to be a high priority in terms of American foreign policy. But I don't think the shared history and all of that really plays anymore. And I think one of the things that's interesting about British politics at the moment is because it's all been very inward looking over the last few years, you probably haven't had the chance for members of parliament to get over here as much as they might otherwise have done and foster relationships further down the ladder. You know, parliamentary congressional relationships can be quite important at times. And we talked before about how Congress plays a role, for example, in ratifying any trade bill. Well, sometimes, you know, if you get the right delegation of MPs going over to Washington and speaking to their mates here on Capitol Hill, that can really make all the difference. But I don't get the feeling there's been a lot of that happening over the last few years. So really, you know, a lot of these people will be starting from scratch and trying to create these bonds rather than being able to suddenly rely on them.
Well, that's everything. Thanks for joining me, Kieran, Rachel and Alex. And thanks everyone for listening. And I hope American politics makes a little more sense. The UK's attempt to woo Donald Trump may well backfire if Joe Biden wins the election in 2 weeks. Though Biden is nothing if not a pragmatist and is still likely to work with the UK, regardless of what's gone before. But the hard truth is, even a Trump win doesn't change the dynamics. The UK has struck out on its own and can't rely on the US to do it any favours. Please do subscribe now for more episodes and make sure you check out our other podcasts. That includes Commons People, which Rachel appears on, and that's our weekly look at UK politics, and they're all available in the usual places. Thanks very much for listening and speak to you again.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.